We turn now to Cashin's Institutes, to Book 5 of the Institutes, which is the beginning of his sequential discussion of each of the tempting thoughts, what Evagrius calls the logismoi, what Cashin tends to call the spirits, or the spirit of any particular temptation or any particular vice, in this case, on the spirit of gluttony. This is the longest of the books of the Institutes dealing with a particular vice, for the reason that it is for Cashin, as it was for Evagrius, the beginning of the vices, the natural human experience, for reasons which we've already discussed. It is the form of experience of the desiring part of the self that can never be completely abstained from. We always have to, at some level, give into or experience or participate in what this natural desire for food leads us towards, and so it's constantly a question of having the proper balance. Let me point out that his method of dealing with issues in these books of the Institutes, each of them covering a different spirit of vice or particular temptation, is generally to end with a series of vignettes or apothegmata. So at the end of this book and at the end of the other books, we'll very often find sayings or stories about the Desert Fathers that illustrate many of the points that he's made. And some of them draw into a kind of a lovely precision, a kind of an almost lapidary or gem-like clarity, some of the issues that he's raised earlier in the book. This is something that he inherits from Evagrius. Evagrius does exactly the same thing in his Practicos and Gnosticos, treat the theoretical aspects and some of the practical aspects in the early part of the book, and then at the very end give stories, apothegmata, sayings, and descriptions of the Desert Fathers as a way of emphasizing the point that he's made, bringing it, as it were, into real life by describing real life people who interacted with these questions. I've divided this very long book up into 8 sections with blue horizontal bars, each of them defining a different subsection, and I'd like to very briefly go over these as a kind of an introduction and a way of introducing this material before you spend time perusing it on your own. The first section, of course, even before the first horizontal bar, is his description of the 8 vices, of the 8 spirits of temptation. We've already seen the ordering of this in both Cashin and Evagrius, and he points out in the second chapter and then again in the third that we begin with gluttony because that's the place where we have the most necessary act of choosing. We must choose about the kind and the amount of food we eat every day. At the first blue horizontal bar, number 1, which corresponds to chapter 4, is a beautiful hearkening back to the story of Abba Anthony, something that we saw in the life of Antony, in which Antony learns his monastic virtues by seeing them lived out in others. Cashin wants to emphasize this, that we have to be willing to learn from the example of those around us, suggesting that what we learn about the way of avoiding excess in food and treating food properly, we'll learn in different ways from different people. But we don't necessarily expect any one person to have the complete perfection of living out any of a particular virtue. We look for the development of virtue in different ways in different folk. In other words, our experience of community is the place where we begin to quest for and search for virtue. Dropping down then, below chapter 4 to horizontal blue bar number 2, Cashin emphasizes the need for moderation and discretion, for balance in one's fasting behavior. One should not fast excessively. It's important that we, as he puts in chapter 5.2, we shouldn't prolong our fast for as long as a week or postpone refreshment during a 3 days abstinence. He points out that this really can make people sick, and especially it should be undertaken with care by those who are advanced age. And so he is a very strong proponent of balance and moderation in regard to respecting the kind of fasting that is possible for any given person. He also points out, interestingly, in number 6, that even though wine may not be readily available in the monastic community, there is a kind of intoxication or drunkenness that doesn't require an alcoholic beverage. Eating too much food can make you muddy-headed or unclear or even full of desires that you otherwise shouldn't have to cope with. So there's a kind of drunkenness that doesn't require the use of a, strictly speaking, intoxicating beverage. He then goes down, if we drop below to chapter 9, he describes again the principle of measure and of balance. Each one should impose such a sparing diet as the battle of his bodily struggle may require. Temperate partaking of food. He should be avoiding the abstinence of prolonged fast, which provides only weariness rather than purity and chastity, which is the goal. So you need to have an asceticism, a regime that you can actually adhere to. It's no good engaging in something for a limited period of time, as we saw with the Evagrius, because it'll only burn itself out and you'll, as it were, burn out and not be able to maintain it. Interestingly, of course, this is experienced by people who attempt to undertake diets, that it doesn't help simply to go on a crash diet and to lose lots of weight. One has to learn to modify one's eating behavior according to one's unique circumstances in order to be able to find a way towards a lasting change. This is something that Cashin is seeing in a very different way, dealing with the question of trying to find moderation and balance in simply the ordinary intake of food. Then dropping down to the next horizontal bar, number 3, this is a rather long section extending from chapters 12 through 20, in which he yet again, and we'll find this frequently in his vocabulary, uses the analogy both of a military battle to describe the battle against vice, and also the analogy of an athletic contest, that we have to learn from those who know from the realm of athletic endeavor what it is to tone up their bodies. We should learn from their example and also recognize that we are engaged in an ongoing struggle with forces that are attempting to undo us. So again, leaving you to peruse this at your leisure, one thing I would highlight under chapter 14 is that he mentions that the mind should be healed or should be dealt with by fasting, vigils, and reading. This is exactly what we've seen in Compunction of Heart. This is almost the same ordering and almost the same phrases that we find in Evagrius Practicos. Again, a reminder of where he is obtaining these insights. That fasting must be undertaken together with other spiritual practices. It's not just a matter of abstaining for food, but it also entails deepening in relationship with God by keeping vigil, by engaging in spiritual reading, lectio, and by the experience of compunction of heart, offering to God one's sorrow for sins. So if we drop down quite a ways to the next horizontal blue bar at chapter 21, number 4, here Cashin emphasizes the importance of spiritual fasting. It's not just a matter of abstaining from food. This should be the external physical reminder of an interior fasting. And he'll make this point again in chapter 27, that we fast particularly from anger. We fast from rendering judgment against others. That inward peace is something that happens when we realize that we're not just abstaining from food, but we're learning also to abstain from all of the things that tend to drag us down, and especially interior things, that is to say, thoughts. There is a fasting that pertains as well to the realm of one's thoughts and one's fantasies and one's desires. To fast from that which is inappropriate and to not make excessive use of that which can just lead us in the wrong directions. The next horizontal blue bar, number 5, chapter 23, is really the beginnings of a chapter on simplicity and balance, a kind of a summary statement of what we've already seen, that one has to be balanced in one's use of gluttony, in one's use of fasting, because he says there is a threefold kind of gluttony. There is eating at the wrong time, There is also eating too much, and there's also eating things that are refined or delicate. And he says one has to be able to deal with all of these things. Dropping down to the next section, fasting is really, he says, in these vignettes about the Desert Fathers, particularly illustrated in Numbers 24 to 26, fasting may be broken and should be broken for the sake of hospitality. It's as if an appropriate use of food, an appropriate abstention from food, teaches us how food can serve the purpose of communion. And so he gives the example of Desert Fathers who were perfectly willing to break their own fast for the sake of guests in order to facilitate this fraternal exchange that gives life. So fasting is not a good in itself, it's intended for a purpose. And the seventh horizontal bar, chapter 27, again, a reiteration of spiritual fasting. We are to abstain from anger and judgment against others. And what I've emphasized is the last little section, or the last thing that I particularly want to highlight, number 8, a very beautiful passage in which he talks about the fact that the purified heart, the heart that has learned both physical and spiritual fasting, the heart that grows in purity, is a natural contemplative. This is a gem of a chapter in which he basically says that purity of heart and contemplation are the same thing. That the heart that has been set free from all of the things that blind it and overwhelm it and weigh it down becomes a natural, easy, normal beholder of the mysteries of the Scriptures. For him, contemplation is principally seeing the presence of God in the biblical text, and this occurs especially for the heart that's been set free from the heaviness that weighs it down, of which the practice of fasting, both physical and spiritual, represents an important practice in moving spiritually forward. As he says, the eyes of the heart are restored to their natural state of health. The mere reading of the Scriptures is sufficient for contemplating true knowledge.